Good afternoon, everybody,
and welcome.
I would like to call the Thursday. Are we okay? Okay, I'm hearing somebody else's microphone. I'd like to call the Thursday, July 30th, 2020 Emergency Board meeting to order. Ms. Heater, will you please call the roll?
Ms. Abram?
Here.
Mr. Varga?
Present.
Mrs. Questenberry?
Here.
Mr. Whitman?
Here.
Mrs. Dunlap?
Here. All right. Would everyone please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. All right, moving on to item 1.04. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit of feedback. Is anybody else getting that feedback, or is it just me?
Tricia Heater, can you mute your mic, please? It appears to be coming through.
Okay, well, she will have to call roll at some point. So moving on to item 1.04, Treasurer Pro Tem, do I have a motion?
So moved.
Moved by Ms. Quesenberry. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Whitman. Be it resolved to appoint Patricia Heater as the Treasurer Pro Tem for the duration of the July 30th, 2020 Board of Education meeting. Does anybody have any comments or questions about that? Pretty standard. Standing in for our treasurer, and I appreciate that, Tricia. All right, seeing none, Madam Treasurer Pro Tem, will you please call the roll?
Mrs. Questenberry.
Aye.
Mr. Whitman.
Aye.
Mrs. Abram.
Aye.
Mr. Varga.
Aye.
Mrs. Dunlap.
Aye. Motion passes. All right, moving on to item 2.01. I would like to welcome Joe Mazzola. Welcome very much from the Franklin County Public Health. He is the commissioner. And I appreciate you being a part of our meeting, our emergency meeting today, as we begin to consider a different approach to the beginning and the start of our new year. So I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about your recommendation, and then I'll probably open up to the floor for some questions, if that's all right.
Well, thank you, President Dunlap. Good evening or good afternoon, members of the Board of Education and Superintendent Brown. It's good to be with all of you this afternoon. Thank you for inviting me to join you, and also want to say thank you hello to all the residents of Reynoldsburg City Schools. So I really appreciate this opportunity to join you this afternoon. Maybe just a couple of comments about kind of where we are with the COVID-19 pandemic and kind of some of the latest thoughts that we're having. And of course, we'll talk about the recommendations that we made yesterday afternoon. Obviously, this has been a very fluid and very quickly changing environment over the last several months. And so I want to sort of set the stage because what we have seen recently has caused us a significant concern. If you look at the number of cases in our county, for the better part of this pandemic, we were averaging anywhere between 100 and 125 new cases per day. And that included, some of the peak levels that we saw in late April and early May. But what started to happen in late June has caused us a really significant concern. Right around in the later part of June, we started to see a very sharp rise in the number of cases in our community. And about a week and a half ago, it's basically tripled since 6 or 8 weeks prior to that. And so you'll probably see that in the recommendation in the memo that we released. You'll see that that trend line and that epi curve, and you'll see how cases have really spiked over the course of that time frame between mid to late June into, you know, mid to late July. And what's really concerning for us on a number of levels is not only have we seen so many new cases, but as we have expanded testing, we have expanded testing to include those who are asymptomatic. And when you do that, you hope to see that, that positivity rate that you hear about a lot, you hope to see that actually decline because we're testing asymptomatic individuals. Well, actually over the course of that same time frame, our positivity rates have actually increased. So a lot of information about back to school. And so what does this mean for back to school at this time? And so we provided a guidance to our school districts several weeks ago before this surge in cases, recommending that, that school districts look at a blended or a hybrid model to come back to school in the fall. And we were very hopeful that that would be the case. And I know that Reynoldsburg City Schools, like all of our school districts, have put in a tremendous amount of work into their return to school plans, and I'm thankful for that. But the circumstances have changed, and unfortunately, they've changed very rapidly. And so when you look at that trend line over the last 4 to 6 weeks, when you look at the fact that our positivity rates are anywhere between 8 to 13% over that time frame, those are over, those are significantly higher than benchmarks that we would like to see to truly advise our school districts that it would be a good time for them to bring kids back into the classroom. CDC recommends anywhere between 5 to 10% positivity rates as a potential benchmark to consider opening schools. And again, we've been above that threshold for the better part of a month. And then from a new case perspective, there are various benchmarks for this. One that we like to use is 40 cases per million per day. So if you look at our county, which is about 1.2 million, you know, we're averaging around 240, 250 new cases per day today. We peaked around 320 just a week or 10 days ago. So we are well over that potential benchmark. And the reason that's important is because in order for us to respond from a public health standpoint, if we have more than those 40 cases per million, we cannot then do the appropriate contact tracing in a timely fashion. It literally overwhelms the public health system in order to respond and control the virus. So we're at a point where we are very much, and we've hired 23 new contact tracers in our department just to keep up. So we're at a point where, you know, we have to look at, you know, ways of slowing this virus down. And so as we think about returning to school, it's really important to think about what is the absolute risk level in the community. That has been what we've come to really better understand and better appreciate. That is the best way to kind of look at how do we bring kids back into the classroom safely. And if we have determined collectively, if we've determined that that risk level is too high in the community, that we need to make a different recommendation to our schools to consider as you look at back to school. And so that was the reason and the rationale for the memo that we provided yesterday. You know, asking our school districts to consider bringing to starting the school year remotely. And then also, and I know this is a very difficult topic as well, but asking our schools to really reconsider those extracurricular activities and sporting activities. We have seen an increase in cases over the last several weeks associated with those activities already. A lot of clusters related to sports across Franklin County. So we know that there's transmission happening as a result of some of those activities. And so, you know, really what this gives us is, this recommendation is it gives us a little bit more time to be able to bring kids back into the classroom safely. And so in the memo, we talk about how we're gonna be working with our school districts over the next 4 to 6 weeks, meeting with them weekly, looking at the data, and hopefully, if we see a sustained improvement in positivity rates, in case counts, we know that there's other indicators as part of the public health advisory system that the state has given us. If we look at, if we can see a sustained decrease, and it's not just a 1 week, we don't want to, you know, look at 1 week, 2 weeks. We want to look at 3 to 4, 4 weeks of sustained declines. Then we would, from a public health standpoint, have much more confidence that we can bring kids back into the classroom and really most importantly, keep them in the classroom. And so I really want to emphasize that. We don't want to open up schools just to have to be able to obviously have to reconsider and closing them. We want to give ourselves the best opportunity to keep our kids in the classroom. And maybe I'll just close by saying, we absolutely appreciate how difficult this decision is. We absolutely appreciate how this may affect families, how it will affect our children and our students. Schools are obviously so critical, not just from an educational standpoint, but from a social emotional standpoint, and just other supports that the school district provides. We absolutely understand that. So these recommendations, we don't come too lightly, but at this point, we felt like this was our best public health guidance. We wanted to give our school districts an opportunity to plan, to have conversation, to be able to deliberate, because we know these kind of decisions to implement, you can't just turn on a dime. So we didn't feel it was responsible for us to wait any longer than we had to before giving you this recommendation. So we understand it could be very disruptive. We understand that this will certainly impact all of our families, our staff, our teachers, et cetera. But at this point, we're hoping that if we can start in a remote fashion, give ourselves a little bit more time, hopefully over time, continue to see a decrease, we'll be able to make a better recommendation. And I guess maybe one more thought. As you look at around Franklin County, one of the hardest hit areas has been the Reynoldsburg area. And I say that, and I'll also say that just, we do have higher case counts in that part of our jurisdiction. But we need to look at this as an entire county, as an entire community. Obviously, people go in and out of Reynoldsburg, for example. They work there, they live there, they visit, they travel. So we're trying to think about this as a community, as a whole, for the whole county, and make sure that we are, providing guidance that really, is data driven and is timely. And so I really appreciate the time this afternoon. Happy to answer any questions that you may have. But we certainly appreciate the significance of this conversation from your vantage point, and we want to continue to be as good a partner as we can to give you the best information to make those decisions. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Mazzola, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'm going to open it up to questions from the board members, because I know they have some. I will wait till the very end. So is there anyone who would like to start? Mr. Whitman, I saw your hand first, and then we'll go to you, Ms. Quisenberry.
Mr. Mazzola, thank you. Thank you for taking the time out to update us here. One thing I was wondering is, with the color-coded four-level threat level that we've been seeing that's based on seven indicators, the rising positivity rate and the rising case counts you're describing now, is that something that, basically, have we reached level four, or are you saying, regardless of that threat level, the data you're seeing now, is bringing you to this recommendation?
So it's all of the above. So that alert system does a really nice job with kind of framing up the risk level in a community, but it's not the entire story. And the reason that we don't advise school districts to base their decision just on that risk level is that as that has been implemented now by the state, they're updating it weekly. So as you have seen over the course of the last month, you've seen counties go in and out of those different levels. And that, to me, we don't want to tie our recommendations just to that particular set of indicators at a particular point in time. We want to look at over a duration of time, those indicators and others, particularly that positivity rate, as a kind of an informative view of the overall risk level of our community. We can't be just looking at one particular point in time. We have to look at this over an extended period of time. But it is important. That is an important guide for us. That's why we mentioned it in the recommendations. Something we're going to be looking at very closely. We are still level three, mostly because of our high incidence of case counts in our community. And so definitely one piece of information, but not all of it as far as how we are trying to evaluate and make our recommendations.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome. All right, Ms. Quisenberry, I think you had some questions.
Yes, thank you. You answered some of my question, and it was at one point with the numbers do we look at to go, to move to our next level. But when we are sustained, you said recommended 4 to 6 weeks numbers being sustained, would it be recommended to go to a hybrid model, or would it be recommended to go to a full day model?
So it's a great question, thank you. So we would like this to, and when we see those declines, it would be our recommendation to move to a hybrid model. In our conversations with our school districts, in order to maintain that 6 foot social distancing or physical distancing, we would not advise that school districts, even in the best of circumstances, bring back all of our kids back into the classroom, because we just don't have the physical space to keep them separated. So we would advise to go to a blended hybrid model, which I know you all have been working on very hard to really think about how to do that. And so that would be our recommendation if and when, and hopefully we will see those indicators move in the right direction.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, Ms. Abram.
Hi, thank you for being here. From your perspective and your experience, are we still in what is considered the first wave of this? I ask in from the perspective of, if we go to a remote model, are we looking at potentially the first 9 weeks, the 2 quarters? Are we looking at 3 quarters? What are we looking at based on your observation of the data and the science and the numbers?
You know, that's another great question. To be quite candid, I don't know if I can answer that.
Sure.
I think we have to be prepared to be flexible and to be able to acknowledge the fact that circumstances, as we've learned over the last 4 or 5 months, that circumstances will change. We just hope that they continue to change for the better. You asked about the first wave, second wave. We get that question a lot. I tend to think of it really as a continuation of the first wave, because when you think about that peak in April and May, we never really got truly back down to, you know, sort of a baseline level. It sort of hung out there for a while. One wave, two waves, it has just been fairly constant. But then what happened in late June with this surge, that's, you know, you could think of it sort of as a secondary wave, if you will, but it certainly comes on the heels of constant, very consistent number of cases behind it. So I think, you know, we would just acknowledge the fact that when we do get to that more of a sustained decline, that you know we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We can't predict that, of course, but we just ask that our school districts be and our families be open to the fact that things may change again. But you know, I just want to go back to the fact that what we're trying to do is give our school districts the best possibility to remain in school, and I think that's why we're trying to be a little extra cautious on this, to ensure that the community conditions support giving us those best odds. Because right now there's really not one good playbook to go on. We just have, you know, kind of a framework to kind of base these decisions on. And we're trying to give our school districts, you know, the best fighting chance to keep these, you know, these kids who deserve to be in school, to keep as many of them in school as possible.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Varga.
Thank you, Madam President. Can I start with asking, are you, for an honorific purpose, are you Mr. or Doctor?
Oh, I guess Mr. I'm not a physician, no.
Okay. Can I ask what the department relied on in terms of meta studies or any other data points that they used to do a general study with other countries that have kept schools open at this point?
So we, in our guidance, we reference CDC, and we also reference an organization called Resolve to Save Lives. We've looked at some studies as well, but the challenge there, if I'm being candid, the challenge there is some of those countries that have reopened safely have community transmission much, much, much lower than what we are seeing in our country. So it's a little bit of an apples and orange comparison. I'm happy to do a little bit more of research for you, but we don't cite those specific articles in our recommendations. No.
Okay, I do understand that distinction. Obviously, some countries, a common example being Sweden, have very different demographical makeups in terms of their cities and their spread out of their population in the cities, which really does help. But I was wondering, since there are some studies that have come out dealing with some of the English and German schools that are fairly similar, mm-hmm. in terms of population density, But I understand where you're coming from those guidelines. The next question I would have is, Reynoldsburg is in three jurisdictional areas for the purpose of the Department of Health from a county level. From a state level, we're of course under just one, and federally we're under one as well. As I look at the districts around us that have acted, districts that are in a similar position, such as Olentangy, have not followed that guidance. They have followed and continued as of last night with their hybrid model, specifically because they have a large portion of their population outside the county. Roughly 40 to 50% of Reynoldsburg population does not live within the county of Franklin. So I'm curious why you think that the projections you're looking at for places like Columbus, places like Dublin, places like Worthington would apply to us with our Licking and our Fairfield residents.
Yeah, that's a great question. Many of our school districts obviously cross over county borders. And so, you know, the data that we're using for Franklin County is not, you know, we're not including other counties within that. So it's a fair question. What we tried to do is provide one consistent recommendation for our entire health jurisdiction. You know, the other counties that are in different health jurisdictions may be coming to different conclusions based on different information. But what we've tried to do was think about our jurisdiction as one community, health jurisdiction, and we wanted to provide a clear recommendation, knowing that, again, looking at the data that we think are important proxies for reopening, we're seeing, you know, those data really go over thresholds that give us cause a lot of concern for us. We understand the political dynamics in terms of residents, you know, where different counties, et cetera, you know, and I think we have that in various school districts across Franklin County. But we wanted to make one recommendation for our health jurisdiction.
Okay. Since you're making a recommendation, in light of some of the previous recommendations as well as orders from the same body historically, usually they reference cholera, smallpox. The most recent that I found referenced the 1957 flu outbreak. Is there any reason that you're not issuing an order and you're only issuing a recommendation?
So, in our view, there's not a need for a Board of Health order at this time. Our Board of Health has not indicated that there is that there be something that they would need to consider that. The statutes for this, are fairly clear in that the Board of Health does have certain statutory authority to close a school building for an outbreak, but with school not being in session now, clearly there, you know, we didn't feel like it would be appropriate to go down that road at this time. So again, this is where we're trying to have good dialogue with our school partners and provide information to boards of education to the best of our ability so that you can make the most informed decisions.
Okay, so when you say we don't necessarily need to do it or we don't feel the need to do it, and then you did switch over to a more positional statement with that, my curiosity is why then are you recommending to all of us to do this? And if we were to, say, follow Olentangy and continue on the day that we open, when you would agree that you have jurisdictional powers, would you seek to close us by order?
So that's it's quite a hypothetical, but certainly if there was an outbreak in a particular building, we would certainly work with the school district to make that determination if that was necessary. We would work with the school district, we would work with the state health department, and then collectively we would make a recommendation if the building had to be closed. That's certainly a scenario that we are having to think about and hopefully not have to actually execute on. And that's exactly the type of scenario that we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid bringing kids back into a classroom at a time when we have significant community spread of this virus. And we're trying to make a recommendation that would give us a better confidence that we can bring kids back into the classroom in a safe way and keep them there.
Okay, I have two final questions and they are related. So currently, based on, as a follow-up of Madam Questenberry's question about the 4 to 6 weeks, if I remember correctly, your guidance last week mentioned 4 weeks, and the original guidance that we received back in March recommended 2 weeks. At what point do we stop extending this period and just say, this is the window we're looking at, this is what we're going to go with? And if we're not willing to commit to a time of that, what are you going to require to say we can go back to school? What condition is going to need to be met for us to get back to school?
Yeah. So I think the 4 week document, you may be referring to Columbus Public Health. In our recommendations, we don't make a time frame, but we do feel like that 4 weeks is a good starting point for a conversation. And I think that's what I really want to emphasize, is that we don't want to set this necessarily as a hard and fast rule of 4 weeks, but we think it's a good starting point for a discussion. What we're really focused on is that absolute risk level in the community. And two things that we're looking for. One is that the case counts. We'd love to see that case count get closer down to that 40 per 1 million. And then the positivity rates, we definitely want to get that in a sustained way under 10% and much closer to 5. But again, this is where, you know, again, I'm just trying to be open and honest. This is where, you know, we want to have that dialogue, because there are no hard and fast rules on this. There's only, you know, some good guidance and framework that partners like the CDC and others have given us. We want to have a dialogue. We want to make sure that we're having that conversation with our school districts to make sure that we are partnering and having that conversation. And, you know, we're going to give you our best recommendation at the time, but those would be two indicators. If we can meet those, certainly over 4 weeks would be a good starting point for the discussion. And then collectively, we'll make that determination in terms of the recommendation in cooperation with our school districts.
We're asking parents right now, 5 weeks from when we restart school, 5 and a half actually, to take a risk on your 4 weeks, which is now back to 4 weeks. You had said 4 to 6 a little bit ago. On your 4 week estimation here, which could change before we restart school, I'm really struggling with the idea that we're going to have an indefinite period here. And that really is, if we're looking at a community rates, because if you can't commit to time with that, we could talk a year, 2 years, 3 years until something is settled. We're going to wait till vaccination, then we have a different debate, you know, and that's not exactly going to be acceptable to parents. And I don't think that should be acceptable to parents. So the reality is, if we're going to have this indeterminate length of time, and if we follow your recommendations, we don't have the resources necessarily to provide everything we need to for that long. We have students on IEPs who need specialized care. We have students who will need absolute care with mental and social development. Our 9X program is designed to focus on the changes that happen when a student hits high school. If we're talking about this, we're already overlapping 1 year of this. We're hitting puberty for 2-3 more years of students. You know, we're going to be missing out on that. What are you guys going to give to us to make all of this work if we're going to last that long? What sort of mental health care, sort of IEP, what sort of parapros, what sort of protections can you give to us?
Well, I don't know if I can speak to that specifically, but what I can tell you is we recognize how difficult and challenging this is. There's no doubt about it. And not being an educator, not being a board of education member, I can't fully appreciate that. I'm just acknowledging how difficult this is. And it has been a difficult situation for every part of our community. So I can't predict how this is gonna play out. What I can commit to the school district, and what we have committed to all of our partners, is that we're going to continue to do everything we can to support you. We have been working with our other county agency partners as we release this guidance. Those who work more in those areas around mental health, child services, other areas of support, we have already reached out to them and said, we need to have a conversation, because if and when our school districts do choose to open up remotely, we need to continue to support them and make sure that we have a strategic support of all of our school districts and their families and the students that they serve. And so that is my commitment to the school board, to the administration here. That'll be our continued commitment will be there. But I can't predict how this will play out. All we can do is really continue to commit to having dialogue, to making informed decisions and recommendations.
I understand the difficulties you're in. I really do. We're in the same exact boat. But to be honest, you're asking us to decide this today. And so it's not a conversation you can have before we're deciding. If we're deciding now, it frankly should have happened, and we should have this information. I do thank you for coming out and wish you the best of luck. Bye.
Thank you.
All right. Any other further follow-up? Okay. Ms. Abram?
Hello again. I had a question about the Ohio High School Athletic Association with regards to the data that you share with them. It seems like there might be some differences in opinion. It seems like they're still trying to move forward, or am I misunderstanding that? So that's, I have two questions, but if you could answer that one, I'd appreciate that.
Well, we have not been in direct contact with the Ohio High School Athletic Association, but it is my understanding that they are trying to work through specific guidance for fall sports. Beyond that, I really couldn't comment as to how they're viewing whether or not they're going to be supporting fall activities in the coming weeks.
Okay. My second question was with regards to daycare. I'm confused in terms of the recommendations you're making to the school in relation to what our governor is recommending in terms of the ratios for daycare. And I was wondering, could you explain some of that discrepancy as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and we really appreciate, sometimes when either guidance comes out locally or at the state level, it may not always line up, and we absolutely appreciate that. So what the governor announced regarding childcare, as you probably all know, is that the childcare providers can return to those pre-pandemic ratios for their class sizes. We view that as a permissive announcement, allowing them to do so. What our role is locally, and what we're gonna be doing, is reaching out to our childcare providers and providing any kind of technical assistance about if and when they do make those decisions to increase their class sizes. It may seem on its surface that those two decisions are incongruent. And really for us, we see those state recommendations as kind of permissive and allowing us to move forward as a state. But then locally, it's our obligation as a local health department to then provide and inform those local operators, whether they're childcare providers or restaurants or what have you, to say, okay, if you make that decision to open up, or if you make that decision to raise your class sizes, here's what's happening in our community. So be thinking about that before you move forward. And then that's what we're going to be doing. We've been working with our childcare providers from the beginning on all of this. We have weekly conversations with them, with their association. And so our commitment has continued to be informing them about what's happening here locally. And that's what we're going to do as far as our next steps relative to the state guidance.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. I had a few questions too, some of my own, some that have been prompted by questions that have been presented to me. But one of the questions, and I think you've answered that when you talked about the 4 weeks of sustained decline, I was kind of wanted you to define decline, but now it sounds like you want to see those case counts closer to 40, correct? And then under 10. Okay, go ahead. So if you would reiterate.
No, I just got 40 per million, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the second part of that, under 10, closer to 5 for the case counts.
The positivity rates.
Positivity rates, thank you. So that's what you're going to be looking for, although, as I understand it, there's going to have to be some flexibility in that as well.
That's correct. And looking again at that, the advisory system for the state, there's indicators there that I think are important to consider. Again, trying to put together as much of a complete picture as we can, but also looking at that over an extended period of time. And 4 weeks, we think, is a good starting place for that discussion.
Okay. And so, you know, obviously there has been different guidance at different levels that has come out as we've been moving through this pandemic, you know, schools, as cities, and as communities, and so on and so forth. So you're making this recommendation now, but looking for this 4 weeks of sustained decline, will you then be, number one, making another recommendation at one point in time? And how often, how will you be communicating that and working with school districts and superintendents as you arrive at that?
Yes, so we have been in very good communication with Superintendent Brown and the Education Services Center of Central Ohio, and I wanna thank them for that. What we've committed to doing is meeting with them every Tuesday morning to go through the latest week's data and really kind of keep them apprised as far as how our trends are moving, so that we don't have to wait 4 weeks and then have the conversation. We don't want any surprises. We want to make sure that we stay in consistent communication with our superintendents as we move forward. And then we can then use those as opportunities to have that dialogue and possibly prepare for those recommendations to change collectively, as you know, in terms of that conversation between the school districts and the health department.
Okay, so we can expect, well, you said possibly expect recommendations. Should I expect a recommendation? I and I'm not asking for a time frame exactly, I understand, but.
You know, I would just say that should the circumstances change in a way that gives us the confidence to make a new recommendation, that we absolutely will do that as soon as we can when we have that confidence to do that.
Okay. Perfect. All right.
And it won't be a surprise to the superintendent because we'll have had those discussions along the way.
On a weekly basis. Okay. Just looking for some sustainability in the leadership there.
Can I jump in quickly just to echo some of that?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Mazzola, for being with us tonight, obviously, and for the weekly conversations we've had. Any information I get on Tuesdays, you guys pretty much get almost immediately. So I keep you in the loop. So if there's anything pending, you're going to already have a feel for what that looks like.
Okay, great. I am happy that this conversation is, you know, continuing, and there is this leadership, and this leadership will be sustained as these conversations continue. So what is the risk rate of transmission among children and adolescents? Because obviously some really feel that it is very low amongst our population, or the majority of our population that's in our schools. So, you know, what is that risk rate, and how does that play into the decision or the recommendation to go online?
That's a great question. So the literature does suggest that the transmission rate for younger children, 10 and under, say, is significantly lower than our older kids, our teenagers. Our teenagers tend to preliminarily tend to act more like adults in terms of that rate of transmission. And so there is a distinction. We think that there that we absolutely acknowledge that. And thankfully, you know, 0 to 19 age group, from a disease burden standpoint, from a morbidity and mortality standpoint, they have fared very, very well, which is a good thing as well, obviously. And so, you know, what we're concerned about is, you know, certainly those older children, you know, 10 and above. We think that there's enough literature to demonstrate that they do transmit the virus at a similar rate to adults. So that's one concern. But then when you think about those who are at risk, whether they're at risk youth, you know, who have complicated medical conditions, who have pre-existing conditions, just like adults. We're potentially putting them at risk. And then when you think about family members who maybe a child comes to school healthy, leaves with the virus, and then of course, maybe they have a parent or a sibling or a grandparent who has underlying health conditions. So, you know, again, I think we would absolutely say that the risk of transmission for children under 10 is significantly lower, and the disease burden for children overall, significantly lower. There's absolutely no doubt about that. The question is, what is the additional risk of transmission, not just for children who are in the schools, but then when we bring in teachers, and support staff and administrators, et cetera, et cetera. So just like any other workplace, we're creating a potential new environment for the virus to continue to spread. So that's kind of how we view it. Those are our concerns about it, and we acknowledge obviously the disease burden for children is not as much of a concern as the opportunity for the virus to transmit from one to another in that environment.
Okay. I know, again, we're talking a lot about risk, and sometimes, you know, you can quantify that and base that on data, and sometimes you can't. But I know that you're well aware of the recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And how has that played into this as well? You know, the mental, you've talked about the social and emotional impact that this has on children. How does that play on the risk to keep them at home in a more isolated environment?
So I think that's where, you know, we actually agree with a lot of what the AAP has recommended, if not all of it. I mean, I think we all acknowledge the benefits of children being in the classroom. We want our kids to be in the classroom. There's no doubt about that. I think the distinction that we want to make here in Franklin County is, again, is what is the virus doing in our community? I want to kind of pull back and say, the AAP recommendations are certainly appropriate. If the circumstances in the community support bringing kids back into school, we can all open up schools. There's no doubt about it. Everybody can open up their schools in the next 3 weeks. Question is, do the community circumstances support it? And then we have to then, to your point, we have to weigh that risk with the other considerations that will have an impact on our students. And that's where I just want to emphasize how difficult, that this decision is. But we have to give you a public health recommendation. And ultimately, it's for the Board of Education to kind of weigh out the others. I'm not an educator. I certainly don't want to speak for those who work in that realm. What we want to do is give you a public health recommendation. And collectively, that's why we really value the discussion. We have to have this conversation, because it's not Franklin County Public Health saying you must do X, Y, and Z. We have to consider all of the aspects of education, and we absolutely recognize that. And we're prepared to play our role in working with other agencies, social service agencies, organizations, et cetera, to do whatever we can to facilitate that. When we're making a recommendation that wouldn't be an ideal circumstance for our kids and for our families.
Okay, I think it's, you say it best too, is when you talk about keeping kids in school, right? So if we can't keep them there, then those benefits that they do have in school are not there. So I think that's it for my questions. And it looks like Mr. Whitman has one more follow-up. If you have the time, Mr. Mazzola, I appreciate it.
Okay, I had to find my mute button. My question is overlaps quite a bit with President Dunlap's about the pediatricians' recommendations. I'll just put in an observation here before my question. I was reading their recommendations again, and they say all policy considerations should start with a goal of having students physically present in school. And we did that. We started with that goal, and we are now reconsidering it in light of changed circumstances. Now, we have the immediate and real risks right in front of us, less than a month out of if we put the kids back in school. But as Mr. Board Member Barga and President Dunlap have observed, there's the social and emotional aspect, and those risks are harder to measure. I mean, if 10 years from now we have, more and worse school shootings than we've ever seen from people who could have, if they just had a little course correction at the right moment when they were in first grade or something. And of course, I have no idea about how to balance, the more traceable risks and those longer term risks that are more diffuse. From a public health perspective, do you guys have any sort of, rules of thumb or just ways of kind of thinking about those kind of long-term and short-term risks?
Well, you know, again, that's a really great question and a very, very important point. We've never had to do this before, you know, in public health, and not certainly not in my lifetime. And I would argue that this is probably an unprecedented situation for all of us. I think for us, again, we have to stay really focused on not just what's ahead of us for the next 30, 60, 90 days, 12 months, but you're absolutely right. This pandemic will have lasting implications and outcomes on all of us. And I don't think any of us can really understand what that's going to be. We have seen a dramatic rise in this community regarding overdose deaths. We've had multiple surges of overdose deaths. We think a lot of that is attributed to isolation because of the pandemic. So, you know, we're seeing immediate effects of this already outside of just the public health implications. And we, of course, and I want to just, I'll just keep saying, we acknowledge that there's so many different facets to this outside of just what we, you know, sort of see right in front of us as far as the morbidity and the mortality of COVID-19. I don't think that there is a really good answer to your question other than to say that, you know, we need to be thinking about short and long term. We need to be thinking about the effects that this will have on all of us. And so, you know, certainly we're trying to get through the immediacy, but we absolutely, from a kind of a long-term perspective, need to think about what are, you know, what are some of those metrics that we should be, you know, thinking about when we talk about recovery from COVID, you know, because there will be a day where we won't have to worry about the virus. You know, it was mentioned earlier, there will be a day when we have a vaccine. We're going to get through all of this, as we've all come to say over and over again, we're going to get through this together. And eventually it'll be behind us, but the residuals of this pandemic will be with us for a long time. And so that's where we think of public health as a public health system. And maybe I'll just end by saying this. When we do our public health planning, whether it's we're talking about chronic disease or mental health and addiction or access to care or maternal and child health, we don't just think about you know, certain parts of public, or what we do at Franklin County Public Health. We think about it as a public health system. So we think about engaging our education partners, our healthcare partners, our transportation partners, our mental health and addiction partners, our social service agencies. You know, we really think about what is the continuum of our public health system and how do we engage those organizations in the planning of those priorities. And I would argue that when this is done, we're going to likely be talking about what do we need to do differently as a public health system because of this pandemic. So when we talk about that in 2021, to your question, I think we're going to be asking that question a lot and thinking about how do we, from a system standpoint, connect with organizations and agencies in a way that recognizes that what we just went through in 2020 was significant, it was dramatic, and it has multiple implications that right now we probably can't even think about and measure, but we have to be willing to continue that conversation over the long term.
Thank you. Yeah, talking about long-term effects, just RSV, the respiratory syncytial virus that my son had as a baby. I'm hearing those effects from that virus we've known about for years are long-lasting and kind of not always predictable. So thank you for being here. I appreciate your time.
Of course.
Madam President?
Yes.
I have a follow-up to that question from Vice President Whitman. You had just mentioned that in 2021, we will be discussing this, and eventually we will have a vaccine, and eventually this will be over. What if it isn't? If you think about the history of infectious diseases, the vast majority are still here. We circulate with them, we deal with them all the time. If you look at diseases of this nature, either they become, you know, a herd immunity level, which takes a fairly significant amount of time with this transition style. There's something like Marburg, which burns itself out before it can impact enough people, or it's something that becomes a residual community and continuous childhood issue. You know, we finally got rid of chickenpox for the most part. There is some resistance to the current method to get rid of it, but for the most part, we finally got rid of that. We've gotten rid of certain ailments, but we still have smallpox in the world. We still have measles. We still have cholera. We still have all of the problems that come with this. So why are you so confident that this is going to end, and why are your plans based on it ending as opposed to projecting that it might continue, since we have no idea how this even works yet?
Well, I guess I'm being optimistic. I'm going off of what our state and national partners are saying. The idea that we're getting closer to a vaccine, the absolute great progress that we've seen in therapeutics for this virus. And so I think from a medical standpoint, we're making really good progress, and I'm optimistic that we're gonna find the vaccine for this. And if we don't, we'll of course have to adjust. But my point to the earlier question was, as we look at kind of what's ahead, when we get past this, we will have to be thinking about those long-term effects on our community, on our residents, and just make sure that we're planning appropriately as a public health system.
All right. I'm sorry, Ms. Quisenberry.
That's okay. Just a clarifying question, Mr. Mazzola. You stated that children 10 and under have a lower transmission rate, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so that's amongst them, each other, amongst other children of that age. But does that mean that they could be maybe asymptomatic and exposing the rest of the staffs? I know our parents are concerned of their children, but as a board, we have to be concerned about the staff and the staff's family and all involved. So even though they have a lower transmission rate, is that amongst themselves or amongst everybody?
So what I'm getting at is that 10 and under tend not to, again, this is early literature, but tend not to shed the virus and transmit the virus in a similar rate as our older kids, who tend to act more like adults. And along that whole continuum, kids absolutely tend to be more asymptomatic than our adults. So the older you get, the less likely you are to be asymptomatic. So those are two distinctions I think are important.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Seeing as there appears to be no more further questions for Mr. Mazzola, am I correct? Again, I know that you're a very, very busy person, and I appreciate you coming and speaking to us, answering our questions, so that those people who could tune in right now would be able to see and hear answers, as well as those who can view it later as it's recorded. And I think that's very important, so that they get the same information that we're getting. So thank you for taking your time, the time out of your busy day. Appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Thanks again for the invitation. And if there's anything else you need from Franklin County Public Health, please let me know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So given the responsible restart plan we already put together, and looking at the level systems, you guys know we somewhat aligned to the level systems, the color-coded system, but we also said that would be one factor we would take into account. We would plan, and given the fact that actually from our population density of students, about 80, close to 80% of our kids are in Franklin County. We would be planning to start the school year in a completely 100% remote fashion. I'm happy to accept any questions I can answer for you tonight. We've talked a lot about this, so you know, a lot of things have not been necessarily mysteries of any sort. We've talked ad nauseum about this for quite a few weeks.
Mr. Brown, I got to tell you, I do not. I am very glad that I'm not in your shoes, to be real honest with you, because I'm sure you've had many sleepless nights. So thank you so very much for what you're doing. These decisions aren't easy. And I just want to let you know that I really do appreciate you and the hard work you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Abram.
Superintendent Brown, can you elaborate? I know we've talked about it ad nauseum as a board, but can you elaborate to the public the status of when you make the recommendation for full remote instruction, what that means for those who signed up for the virtual academy?
Sure. We're still going to be signing up for the virtual academy because we anticipate at some point we're going to have in-person instruction. And for those families who are not comfortable coming back into buildings, that is still going to be available at that point. If we're starting in a 100% remote fashion, however, we're all going to start in the same way with the same amount of support from teachers, our teachers, doing that on a daily basis. And let's say, let's project to the end of the first quarter, let's say we're able to have in-person instruction in a hybrid fashion, that's when the virtual academy will start, and those students who are registered will simply slide over to that and begin support in that way.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Any other questions? Mr. Whitman?
Thank you, and thank you, Board Member Abram, for asking that question there. I was curious about it too, and Mr. Superintendent, yes, okay, I can see that we need to hold on to that option so that, you know, if we, as you say, eventually go all in, those parents who are still uncomfortable with it, will still have that option. Let's see. I had this list of, for the viewers, I have a list of questions here, and some of these have already been answered just in the course of the presentation. So I'm just trying to see the ones that I haven't asked. Okay, so a few questions that are just kind of about what this would look like for teachers. So if teachers now need to plan for all virtual rather than hybrid with a possibility of virtual, what kind of changes do you envision us needing to make in order for them to prepare adequately? And also, would teachers have a choice of whether to work from home or in their mostly empty classrooms? And how would consultations with counselors or intervention specialists or the like have to be handled under an all virtual model?
Okay, you had a three-tier question there, so I'm gonna try to make sure I hit all of them.
Basically, what are the teachers gonna do?
The planning we've been doing since June in terms of professional development has been focused on digital learning. So our teachers are far more equipped now than we were back in the spring to get this done. That won't change that drastically, but the preparation for it will be different because they have to build platforms in terms of being prepared to do a 100% remote learning avenue. We still have a few weeks left, and no, the work is not done yet, so that is still a work in progress in that respect. As far as teachers working from home or in buildings, right now we anticipate our staff coming into buildings and using our infrastructure to provide that support to kids. Consultation with counselors, therapists, what have you, we will figure out what that looks like. If we may be in a position at some point, I'm hoping we can do this from the very start, we may be able to bring in small groups of kids to get certain services. We may be able to do that. I don't know that definitively as of yet, but I anticipate that being a possibility. There are a lot of moving pieces between now and then, so there are a lot of questions I can't answer, unfortunately, and I know that doesn't sit well with everyone, but I will not sit here and give you information that I don't have or make it up as I go along.
I thank you, and I appreciate that. I will ask the questions, and if they don't have an answer yet, saying that we don't have an answer yet, that's fine. I understand that will sometimes be the case.
All right. Anybody else? Any other, Mr. Barga?
Yes, Madam President. Mr. Superintendent, I do wish to first apologize for my incorrect number of the students. I was basing that on the voting data, and I incorrectly
I knew that.
Yeah, I guess that we just projected it down that way. I probably should have included that in my giant list of questions to you this morning. And I actually do want to reference that to the large amount of the community that posted on various things on Raider Strong and Proud and some of the other Facebook community groups. I summarized, and I actually have a long list of the questions, and I sent it over to the superintendent earlier today. He got me solid answers to every single one as much as he could at this point. Obviously, we approved the original plan 9 days ago. We just, in some ways, altered it, or at least recently that became to the forefront that it was going to be altered. So a lot of it is still work in progress. I was originally intending to read it out, a lot of the answers.
But what I think I'll do, just to save time, especially since I don't think we're going to be taking an action on this item, since it sounds like the superintendent is going to exercise the discretion that we had given him before. So I will instead be summarizing it in a better format and posting it on my page so that parents can reference it and otherwise use it, or, you know, ask me follow-ups, and frankly hold us accountable on the ones that we say, you know, this is going to come on this date, and if we don't have it, then, you know, remind me that I said that and I'll go poke the superintendent again. Sorry, Melvin.
If I could add, Mr. Barger, that list I'm also going to share with the rest of the board tomorrow afternoon.
Thank you.
Anything else, Mr. Oh, I just look for his mic to go on and off, and that's how I kind of
sorry. So,
that's right. Superintendent Brown, you have been meeting pretty consistently, regularly, recently with the commissioner, have you not? And with other school districts, and trying to kind of collaborate, and this communication has already been established, and you anticipate that to continue?
Oh, definitely. Franklin County superintendents, for the most part, have been pretty much on the same page. Many of the changes that we're discussing right now started on Monday with a board meeting in a different school district, and has simply followed suit. I knew of some of those changes as early as Monday night, and so on Tuesday morning when we met, we talked about what things would look like, what the recommendations were, how we were going to function, and try to be somewhat of a united front. So that we could all be in the same boat, so to speak. And then President Dunlap and I talked about scheduling this emergency meeting. So here we are, where we would actually put our decision in place.
Mm-hmm. So, and I appreciate you accommodating my request to at least have a representative from the Department of Health's office, mm-hmm. so that everyone here would have ample opportunity to ask questions and better understand the recommendation beyond the one page, or at least I think that it was. If you could kind of reiterate and talk about, I know some people have asked, I think it's worth reiterating that we did approve a framework, as Mr. Barga said, 9 days ago. And this framework did include 100% virtual, correct? So, you know, we have had a plan, correct? It's not like we haven't had a plan. We've had a plan, we've corrected, and we talked about shifting, and this is one of those times when at least the health officials are telling us that we really need to shift, correct?
Well, if you go back to last week's board meeting on Tuesday night, we specifically talked about the fact that the game could change the following day. That was part of the conversation from the very beginning. The framework we developed kind of accommodates exactly what we're doing. We said we would weigh a number of different factors to make decisions, and that's pretty much where we are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I commend you and everyone else on your team and this board for supporting making every effort to get kids back into school in a hybrid model at the best way that we could, but acknowledging the fact that if we can't keep them in mm-hmm. school, that we're really undermining our entire process. It's important to provide them with an environment that they can stay in school. Otherwise, right. All our work is for naught. And
Go ahead. I just wanted to say a quick word about sports, because I know there are a ton of questions about that. And some of this is still nebulous, because we're waiting for guidance from the Ohio High School Athletic Association in some regard. Our district has moved all of our activities back to phase one. Football has been shut down because of a positive case. Otherwise, they would still be meeting in those 10-person pods. But because we're in phase one, that means a number of other sports could probably still do some of the activities they need to do. So, for example, golf, girls tennis, volleyball, I would still foresee those things continuing I see those sports continuing to have activities, but we're just in phase one of what that looks like.
Okay. There were quite a few questions about those, if there was going to be a decision on some changes. I know that has varied amongst districts. So
volleyball tournaments are coming up. I know there was a question out there about that, so they're coming.
Okay. Any other questions for the superintendent? Okay. Seeing none, we will move on to item 3.01, the school calendar. Do I have a motion?
So moved. So,
boom by Mr. Barga, second by Ms. Pressenberry.
Sorry, Jenny, just had to.
That's all right.
Superintendent Brown, do you want to give us a little bit of background on why we sure. have this again before us tonight?
Sure. First, I want to give the calendar committee a lot of thanks for putting this together. A lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of energy went into this, a lot of collaboration. So I don't want to skirt any of that as if it didn't happen, because there was a lot of that. We did get a lot of feedback on the current calendar that's currently approved, specific in reference to where professional development days may lie, when the end of the school year would come, how long certain breaks were. And so we took that into consideration and kicked around a few ideas in conjunction with the REA president, and came up with a new proposal that I think alleviates most, or I won't say most, I'll say many of those concerns.
Okay, are there any questions for the superintendent or any comments?
Thank you for doing that. I want to tell the millions of teachers who sent emails that we heard you and that you heard them. Yes, thank you for making this adjustment. But just to clarify, it really doesn't affect the start date, so parents know that those dates are still set.
Well, what this calendar does is the start date is now earlier and shifts to August 24th.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Mr. Whitman.
Okay, yeah, so first I want to make sure I kind of get the highlights of the calendar change that we've done here. So, I mean, yeah, no calendar ever satisfies everyone, but I have to say we've heard a lot more, you know, after the decision feedback with this one than with others. And I'm guessing that it's directly or indirectly just all relating to COVID and all the changes that is precipitating. And I know that, I mean, the earlier calendar was developed in consultation with REA. They had representation on the committee. This one too was developed in consultation with REA. So, so both that one and this one, had teacher input on here. There's a calendar committee, or Mr. Superintendent, kind of have any impressions of like, well, why this one is more likely to be the one that, you know, that the majority of them want than the earlier one was, since they both were developed in consultation?
I'll give you two of the biggest pieces. Two professional development days in September were moved to the beginning of August. So we have a full week of PD before the school year actually starts. That's one factor. And the last day of school for students will be before Memorial Day. So I'd say that's on the other end. Bookend those two things, I'd say that's it in a nutshell. Other than that, it probably wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment.
Okay. And looking at the approved calendar and the proposed revision here, if I add up all the instructional days, professional development days, and either, you know, days off or actual holidays, the approved calendar has a total of 205. This one has 210. Have I miscounted somewhere?
Those numbers aren't relevant. You're looking for the number of work days that we're actually getting on the calendar. So teachers have to have 184. That's what we have accomplished within the calendar.
Okay. Let me see. Well, I have one. So in other words, the instructional days plus professional development needs to equal 184.
Yes.
Okay. And it looks like in the proposed revision that comes, and I actually have it at 188.
You're not looking
at it. Counted.
You're not counting half days.
Okay. All right. So basically the relevant number is the same for these calendars. Okay.
Yeah.
And I know that, and I can see in the revised calendar that many of the sort of packet of suggested revisions that you know that came in many of the emails are in there. One that that is not is having like 10 or so professional development days at the beginning of the year and hardly, you know, anywhere else. And looking at neighboring districts, I see that like Columbus and Southwest Licking and Gahanna, they do indeed have something like that. And so I'm wondering, you know, what are our thoughts on something like that, especially as first teachers planning for all online versus, you know, hybrid or whatever else?
Well, given that we don't know what this is going to look like between now and the end of the school year, I think we need to have some points at which we could shift and have an opportunity to do that. Those days throughout the year allow us to do that. Front loading all that basically says if we're going to shift, we got to shift tomorrow. And obviously that's not appropriate.
So if I understand correctly, we've done a lot more front loading than we did, but we don't want to go all in like, you know, like I see on the calendars from the other remaining districts, because that really cuts off our options. We want to hold something in reserve for whatever happens.
Yes.
That we have a few. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other comments or questions? Ms. Abram?
Thank you. Most of my questions were answered with what Vice President Whitman asked. But I wanted to know, obviously, we can't teach without the teachers wanting to have their calendar the way that they're proposing. You know, we all received, a ridiculous amount of emails, honestly. And I'm glad that the teachers are advocating for their students and everything. But I guess I'm confused as to, they came with the first calendar and now here we are with this calendar. I don't understand what was the uproar. Like, is there any way you can clarify without divulging too much information as to why? Because, just last week, all the parents were thinking they were starting after Labor Day. Now we've got a calendar that's telling them, whoop, change that up again. You know, now we're going to do something different, or we're proposing to do something different. So I feel like, yes, the teachers, we can't teach without teachers, but the parents also need to know why we're making this proposal change.
I think with the shift to all virtual, we could start a little bit earlier because we're not necessarily in a position where we're preparing buildings to receive X number of students and people on a regular basis. So that's one reason we could have done it. Other than that, I have some personal thoughts about why we're here. And as I said earlier, it's probably not appropriate for me to comment. But I guess I want to make it clear that, you know, the committee does make recommendations. We still build the calendar. We still approve the calendar. So we took input, and it doesn't necessarily mean it, because I'm upset about the way something looks, I can complain about it and it changes. That's not necessarily how this works. I think we're being cordial and collaborative to make this happen. And so this is where we've landed.
Okay. One further question is, who is our calendar committee? Because I thought I was a member of it as well as Mrs. Kessenberry. And I haven't been involved in any of this, so I'm not sure. How does this go?
The two of you are the reps, but they have only met here in the spring, and I guess we never made the transition to have you start, Ms. Abram.
Okay.
But we also have representation from REA and from the administrative staff.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Madam President?
Mr. Barber.
To start, just to respond slightly to Board Member Abrams' question about the calendar committee. If I remember correctly, the calendar that we are now modifying the modification of, or at least considering for action, is one that Madam Questenberry and myself built over a fairly long period of time. That's with correct. A lot of representation, a lot of back and forth. There were many, many versions that Dr. Cosgrave gave out, to the point where she was getting having a lot of fun with the color combinations. We got to that point. So when we referenced the committee, I think a lot of that's referencing the back and forth we did with the REA as well as other stakeholders to build okay. it. And we even put the information out to the community and asked them for feedback at that point, which is something historically not necessarily done in our district and something I'd love to see you guys continue when we get a normal calendar. Beyond that though, I do want to echo the statement that I really do appreciate a lot of the emails. What I do want to say is some emails are more persuasive than others. And when we get emails, I don't think the volume is what matters. We got certain emails that were one paragraph long that detailed what impact the teacher needed to be able to plan for their classroom for the year. We got other emails that would violate our plagiarism rules. And some of them had changed signatures, some of them didn't even have changed signatures, and they were identical. And we got a lot of those. Those are a lot less persuasive because they don't tell me what that individual teacher needs. I understand what the organization needs. The organization, our teacher union, and our support staff union, for that matter, have representation, and we work with them. We work hand in hand all the time. From the get-go, Superintendent Brown was telling us exactly how he was working with the unions back in March and the MOUs that we were working on and all of the details. And it's still an ongoing process. So I think for the future, when we deal with calendar stuff from the teachers, I really do value your position because I don't know how to build a classroom. I don't know how to plan for these tests. I don't know your pedagogical approaches. But if you can provide that to me, if you can send me an email, if, you know, even if you send me the same form, a couple people added a paragraph or two, and that really helped me understand what they were looking for. And I think that's really essential here is we have to work as a team when it comes to this, because no matter what we like with our overall picture of what we're doing, all of our pieces have to be able to work in it. So I appreciate the effort the superintendent did with the original surveys. I understand our original percentages. And frankly, we might currently be voting in a way that the minority wants, but that's what we were sent. And that's the communications that we were sent if we approve this. I think that's a reality we have to face. And as we look at our different systems, we kind of have to figure out how are we going to adjust this calendar if we have semesters? You know, how are we going to adjust this if now that it would be starting earlier, it comes back a week after we start school. Now, you know, okay, we can start getting in school again. I think those need to be explored. So I'm really hoping that we have a commitment here, Mr. Superintendent, that this is it. We're not going to take any more feedback. This is our final calendar for this period. So our parents know when the school starts, our support staff knows, our teachers know, everyone can plan their doctor's appointments, their vacations, everything in that giant list that we got sent. You know, we need to make sure we have this finalized for them.
I can assure you I won't be putting anything else on the agenda.
Okay. So in that case, you know, I do support this. I don't like the fact that we're doing it the way that we are and we weren't able to have the same build that we did before. But I think it's a good idea to accommodate what the teachers are currently requesting and see if we can build a system that actually allows them to do what we need to do, since right now we're going all virtual and odds are some point in this first semester, hopefully we are going to change it on you. So you need time to plan.
Just for a point of context, I do want to stress that a lot of teachers were really interested in having more preparation time on the front end, and I applaud them for sending that information.
Okay.
I might add to Board Member Barger's comments there. Yes, I agree that I don't like the decreased certainty and trust that approving this calendar a week after we did the other one is going to do, and I think we need to have a really good reason to do it. I think the changed circumstances involving the virus and now knowing that we're going to start off all virtual is part of it. Also, I'll say that all the emails that had, you know, the very same text, I don't consider that plagiarism because I certainly copied and pasted my share of, you know, recommended texts to, you know, to various legislators. And being on the receiving end of it, I'll say that, you know, when I read one, it's just the same. It's like, oh, good. Okay, I've read this. I don't have to read I'll skim it to make sure there's not a a personalized paragraph, but otherwise I'll put a tick mark by the by the number of people asking for the same thing. Those who personalize it, I certainly appreciated that too, but I don't ever want to tell somebody, don't send me a letter unless you can personalize it, because not everybody has time to, compose something and polish it and put it in paragraphs on their own. Even me, and I like writing in general. That said, all the letters I got, the thing that is influencing me the most to say yes to this is the fact that Mr. Brown, the revisions you're coming to us with, done once again in conjunction with REA leadership. And I'm trusting that Ms. Cooper got plenty of feedback from, from REA rank and file. And the fact that, that what she came to you with and what you and she worked out mirrors a lot of what we've been seeing, but not, but not entirely. I take that as a sign that, okay, we're listening to the input, and then we're tempering that with, the considerations that you need to have about holding back some PD days for contingency. So, thank you.
Okay. I am going to, I think, echo some of the comments that have already been made. Number one, I'd like to remind everyone listening that it has always been our number one goal to make the health and welfare of our students and our staff a priority. And that has not wavered, and it will not waver. I will be supporting this calendar tonight, but I'm doing so with reservations. And I'd like to briefly air a few of those as well. I appreciate that it's been a collaborative effort between the district, the Board of Education, and that did originate with those on the calendar committee when it was originally devised last year. The staff, and all of this in compliance with the REA negotiated agreement. There has been teacher representation all along the way as we've made revisions to this original calendar due to the pandemic that we're in. And from the start, I have supported more professional development days up front in order to give our staff and our families the time that they need to prepare for this unprecedented time. And in fact, I will mention there was a survey given to teachers during the revision process asking them if they preferred the 3 days to the 5 days front loaded in order to prepare. And 71.1% voted for the 3 days. Now it's brought up to me that some of them felt they didn't have enough information in order to properly make that decision when given those two different options in the survey. But I'm not so sure that if more days were desired, then why would it not be the obvious choice to choose 5 days as opposed to the three? Secondly, I do struggle with whether or not I am listening to a vocal minority when the number of letters I received, and I think we all received about the same amount, while they were noteworthy, it's a small percentage of the entire teaching staff. So that is something that I struggle with, that in hand in hand with the survey results. I've asked for some of these changes based on the feedback, though, like more professional days upfront in order to prepare. But again, I struggle with that decision. Third, one of the letters that I received, and I received many, many copies of this same exact letter, it noted that front-loaded professional development days were needed to plan, which I completely understand, and for time with fellow teachers, which I agree wholeheartedly. But I struggle as to why the survey then indicated otherwise. But I personally feel that those front-loaded days are essential in order for our staff to prepare for the school year. Finally, I'd just like to say that I applaud the fact that we were starting later in the year in order to give everyone time to adjust the plan during these unprecedented times, but that those start dates and the ending date seemed to cause a lot of angst. I can remember my kids here in Reynoldsburg schools ending after in June many, many years. But apparently this did cause some angst. And so we have adjusted. I do want to thank everyone who sent me letters, particularly those who did take the time to personalize them and give me their unique circumstances that does give me the ability to understand what they are facing a little bit more when I read letters like that. It's my hope that this final collaborative effort will serve as it'll serve our staff and our students as we move forward during this pandemic. I support this final version, and I thank Melvin and his staff and Kim Cooper and her staff for arriving at this solution. If there are no further comments or questions, Madam Treasurer Pro Tem, I'm sorry, Ms. Heater, I'm like, what do I call you? Will you please call the roll?
Yeah. Mr. Varga.
Aye.
Mrs. Quessenberry.
Aye.
Mrs. Abram.
Aye.
Mr. Whitman.
Aye.
Mrs. Dunlap.
Aye. Motion passes. If there are no other questions or comments, I will make a move on to item 4.01 is a motion to adjourn. I have a motion?
President?
Yes, Mr.
Before we move to that very quickly and briefly, for parents of Eastland Fairfield students, plans were released earlier today. I don't know if they've gone public yet, but they were mailed out. You should be receiving the Eastland Fairfield reopening plans in your mail. For the board, the superintendent, I believe, mailed those out to us earlier because he had received them from the superintendent up there. And as soon as we have a posting on Facebook of them, I'll also get them out on social media as well. So for parents concerned about your Eastland Fairfield reopening plans, we have those released and should be available to you today or tomorrow. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Varga, would you mind sending those along to the board members? We may be getting questions or concerns from, people that from our families who attend Eastland Fairfield, and I would like to see those in the rest of the board as well.
I received that right before the board meeting started, and I already sent it to you.
Oh, all right. There you go. You're one step ahead of me. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Superintendent.
Thank you.
All right. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
I'm like, second. No one wants to finish up.
I'll second it then.
Moved by Mr. Whitman, second by Mr. Varga. Madam Treasurer Pro Tem, please call the roll.
Mr. Whitman.
Aye.
Mr. Varga.
Aye.
Mrs. Abram.
Aye.
Mrs. Quessenberry.
Aye.
Mrs. Dunlap.
Aye. Motion passes. Thank you all very much for your time this evening and your attention to this matter. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Stay safe, everyone.
Stay safe. Tough times.